recording now. So I'm Tom Sturdy, and I'm recording on the 10th of July, 4:15. And joining me today is
Brian Van Arkady.
And could you also state your date of birth for me?
May the 28th, 1935.
Perfect, Brian. So could you give me a little background about yourself to begin with? What you've done since leaving Guernsey?
I've been a development economist, I've been an academic, I've been an economic advisor, a lot in Africa. In the last 25 years, or 26 years, a lot in Vietnam. I spent about 3 months every year in Hanoi. I've more or less retired now, as of last year, but not totally. I'm still publishing. I've taught in all sorts of places. In England, in Sussex and Cambridge, and Yale, Dartmouth in the States, and so on.
And what subject?
I'm a development economist. That's why, besides being an academic, I've worked a lot as an economic advisor and writing about interesting economic situations. I've written books on a lot of really disparate topics. I've got one book on the West Bank and Gaza Strip, another one on the Baltic States. I've written a lot on Vietnam and a lot on East Africa. I went to East Africa 52 years ago, and have been there more or less ever since, on and off.
Okay. So your studies at LSE, what do you remember about the course here?
Oh, of course, an awful lot. I did the BSc in economics, which is interesting enough, a rather small specialism. There weren't so many people that did economics as such. And in those days, part one was a two-year program, and which one did a bit of everything. And probably, I would suppose, the strength of LSE in those days is they had a very strong tradition of having very impressive lectures. I discovered when I went to teach at Cambridge how unusual LSE was, because in Cambridge no one gave a damn about lectures. I was giving them or listening to them. But here there was a very strong tradition. I could talk about all sorts of people who lectured me. I've got some, strange enough, one of my most interesting memories of those first 2 years at LSE, that's 52 to 54, was a course I took virtually by accident, and I was never examined it because they changed the rules about that time. Instead of taking 9 subjects in part one, you did 8. So I dropped that subject because I was a bit scared. But that was logic and scientific method. And I wandered into that lecture because it sounded as I was 17 at the time. It sounded as though it was something you should know something about, but I didn't have a clue what it was about. And of course, it was an extraordinary lecture because for 2 hours every week, Karl Popper, who was one of the major figures in the history of LSE, would lecture to anyone who wanted to come, including myself, a freshman, graduate students, and even postdoctoral students, including a couple of very famous, I think Lakatos was there, and Fire Abbott, became very famous philosophers in their own right. And I have one specific memory which deserves to be put down in historical annals, because it is vaguely amusing. We met in a room that's probably not even used as a lecture room now. It was a basement room just below the entrance in the old building, and Popper was a ideological libertarian, but like many libertarians, he had a slightly authoritarian personality. So he would say, "You can interrupt me and ask me anything you want." So these hotshot postdoctors always interrupting him, trying to prove he was wrong about something or challenge him, and he would destroy them, just destroy them. I used to sit next to a Nigerian lad, a very handsome young man, who was very shy, however, and eventually timidly put up his hand to Popper. Popper said, "Yes, what is your question?" He said, "Professor Popper, I'm just wondering, why is his room so cold?" So Popper said, "At last, an intelligent question. Wait." He disappeared for 10 minutes, then came back and drew a picture of the heating system, explained why it didn't work in the basement. But that's a small story about Karl Popper. Anyway, you had to be a bit, you know, I mean, I listened to lectures all sorts of people, of course. And those days, probably particularly strong department at LSE with economic historians, particularly on British economic history. So one heard all these people who were the major figures in teaching economic history. And one was also very heavily involved in politics. One small piece of history, though it is of some minor significance, is that I was the first socialist to be defeated in the election for the presidency of the Students' Union, I think in the history of LSE. In 1955, I ran as the president, just following Bob Weinberg, who was here visiting the States last week. And Roland Brown, who sadly, was it Brown? No, Roland Freeman. Roland Brown, someone else. Roland Freeman, who was a much more mature student and actually quite a remarkable chap in a way, was conservative, and he won the presidency of the Students' Union, which meant I never became a politician, which probably was just as well. In those days, LAC was still very much a leftist place, you know. In 51, the great figure of the past died, Lasky. I don't know if you picked him up in the other interviews you had, but Lasky was a really dominant figure and a major figure in British politics. He was even at one point chairman of the Labour Party. He died, and then the LSE began to make an obvious, I suppose, more or less conscious shift to the right, because when he died, he was replaced by Michael Oakeshott from Oxford, who was a rather conservative political philosopher. Very good lecturer, I must say. I attended lectures. But that changed things. And in fact, the only real disciple of Lasky who tried to keep the flame flying was Ralph Miliband, who was a very lefty guy. He was never actually in the Communist Party, but he was always left the Labour Party. And as you know, his sons went into that business. And he was, you know, the only obvious figure on the left figure on the political side, though a lot of the graduate students were quite radical. There was a redoubtable Communist Society, and there was a Labour Society, and there was a Socialist Society that appealed to people who would probably be called fellow travellers in those days, like people who were on not Communists but not hostile to the Soviet Union. And there was a figure, you should dig up and try and find what happened to him, called Colin Sweet, who was the, Colin was the leader of the Communist group. And if you knew Colin socially or politically, you would get invited once a year to the Russian embassy for a big, you know, the only time most of us had a chance to drink vodka and eat caviar. And this is rambling. Well, the whole thing's rambling, obviously. But after that, a cultural attaché, which means he probably was a spook, because that's what, on both sides, normally people who are spooks have that job, took me out to dinner a couple of times in Gerrard Street. Now, the reason I mention that, this is a bit of oral history, not about LSE, but about London. Gerrard Street is now known as Chinatown. You've probably eaten there. But in those days, there was not one Chinese restaurant or one Chinese shop in Gerrard Street, not one. There was a Chinese restaurant on Shaftesbury Avenue in Hong Kong. So what's happened there, I found quite extraordinary. A lot of other things happened in London. Anyway, I'm rambling, so ask me some more precise questions, Tom.
So you mentioned already various societies that you were involved with. What was your social life like as a student?
I came up at 17. I was a bit naive. I was virginal. Interested, but never quite managed to make it. I was living at home, which was one constraint. I was a working-class kid who didn't expect to go to university. I came from Kentish Town, which in those days was a real working-class area. I went to school in Soho, actually. So when I came to LSE, I just got a different bus in the morning. And so in that way, I was probably you know, probably with less flourishing social life than I'd had if I were living in town on my own. I didn't only engage in politics, which was an important part of my time in the Labour Society, but I was also rowing. And so social life around the rowing club was quite important. It was very, very different. I mean, two different milieus. One was a highly intellectual group of kids who were interested in left politics, and the other were guys interested in beer drinking. So one certainly did a lot of that. And all right, and then the other thing I remember is it was already extremely cosmopolitan. I mean, I remember how many of my friends were actually from Africa, India, and the US. And and of course, one went out. You know, if you were thinking about, if you're interested in writing about oral history of social life, one can think of the sort of changes that happened on the ground in London at that time. You know, students didn't have much money. There were only two or three restaurants that one would go to. One was the German restaurant Schmitz on Charlotte Street. But that was also the time, about the time I came up in 1952, actually, when the Italian coffee bar appeared. You know, these espresso machines suddenly appeared. And all over central London, there were suddenly these coffee hangouts, which were quite new, you know. And they had a big effect on youth culture. There were also a few jazz clubs. I remember going to them. Cy Lawrie's and Ronnie Scott's, places like that.
Did you ever go to the Free Tons?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Do you have any memories of that?
Sometimes a bit hazy. No, it was one of the places where I'm drunk. I mean, LSE was strange. Many of my fondest memories are sitting on a radiator, actually. There was no actual social facilities at all. So you would go to Wright's, where Wright was actually there. I mean, Wright was an actual person, rather grumpy old man who ran the place. One would go to Three Tons. One would hang out in strange places. Like in those days, you still had the Lion's Tea Rooms. There was one around the corner. You might go over there for tea. You would try to not spend too much time in the refectory, which was awful. And having had a lunch here last week, where I was invited for the legacy lunch, the food was equally awful. So I guess they'd maintain that tradition. So it was a rather... and then one would move around with friends who did live by themselves in town. One of them is on the list here, Gabriel Newfield, who was a contemporary of mine. And he lived in a flat just south of King's Cross. And I remember sometimes sitting around all night arguing politics with him and so on. Another guy who's coming here tonight, I saw, is Frank Judd. You know, Frank later went on to become a very successful Labour politician and became a Lord as a result. I don't think he remembers, but I nominated him for the first political job he ever ran for, Deputy President of the LSE Students' Union, which he won, it must be said. Another guy who was here then, who was a very shy, unassuming guy, obviously very, very nice, is Alf Dumps. Have you talked to him yet? Now, Alf is also a member of the House of Lords, and he just come up again in historical context, because he was one of the people saved from Czechoslovakia in that famous, well, it wasn't famous until recently, but there was a guy who died last week, actually, who got a lot of children out of Czechoslovakia and just before the war started, a lot of Jewish kids, and he was one of them. And was an undergraduate here, I guess became a Labour politician, now a member of the House of Lords.
Change the subject slightly.
And social life, okay. In those days, the Students' Union would have dances every two or three weeks in the refectory, where you either went and danced and came with a girl or tried to pick up a girl, or you hung around the bar singing vulgar songs with the rugby club. So,
change the subject slightly. What do you remember about the buildings of LSE campus, their sort of sites and their...
Yeah, there were two buildings, this one and the one across the road. In fact, one of my memories, specific memories, is having dinner the year after I graduated, when I sort of graduate student here with Alexander Carr Saunders was then the director. I remember the big topic of that dinner was whether they should build a bridge between the two buildings, which they did subsequently, as you know. But it was a very limited physical place. In other words, we're talking history, another little bit of history. When I organised this celebration for the sixth... Well, let me explain how I came to do that. Roland Brown, having defeated me and discovering I was going to be back as a graduate student, and we rather got on well together, although we were in political opponents, invented a job for me and the students' union, which was basically to look after visitors. So for a year, any really distinguished visitors who came and wanted to meet students or were invited to lecture and so on, I would look after them. So I remember meeting all sorts of people, and in this place I had tea with Lord and Lady Beveridge, you know, who was the great director of the LSE in the 20s and 30s, taking Richard Crossman, who later taught a Labour minister, out to dinner and so forth. Now, when I organised this 60th anniversary, we did it appropriately in Birches Webb House, which was a sort of Labour conference centre somewhere in Sussex, I think, or in the North Down somewhere. And we had a sort of long weekend conference about that. And one of the things I have, which is a little piece of history actually, is I had to invite people, and I really didn't know much about the very early history of LSE, but I just thought, who is around and still alive, who was alive then? And one person was Bertrand Russell. So I wrote a letter to Bertrand Russell, inviting him. He was then already quite ancient, in his 80s, and he wrote a very gracious letter back saying, well, he didn't do this sort of thing too much anymore. Even Tawney, who came, was pretty odd by then. But then he said something, which should be part of your history of the LSE, if that's what you're doing, that he well remembered that in the first session of LSE, in 1895, when essentially the LSE was meeting in a set of rooms below Bertrand Russell's rooms, that he actually gave some lectures on German social democracy. So that was sort of extraordinary, because that was 60 years before. So one had these sort of links. Lionel Robbins was a slightly pompous, very magisterial figure. He later became Lord Robbins, of course, because he was... And, of course, for me as a young Cockney lad from North London, was all this was a bit overpowering. And for me, he was quite important because he did two things. When I graduated, in those days we had national service, I should have joined the army. And I remember going out to East London, Acton, I think it was, for a medical, and in my underpants appearing before three elderly superannuated doctors. And looked at each other, looked at me in my underpants, shook their heads and said, sorry, young man, we won't be needing you. So I then suddenly didn't, I was expecting to go from LSE to the army for 2 years. Suddenly I didn't know what to do. So I went to see Robbins, and I remember downstairs here, floor below, I think. And, he's a very magisterial professor. And I said, well, professor, I'm evidently not having to do national service, I wondered if you give me advice what to do. And I remember him looking at me and said, Ben Arkady, you're a good man, I think, but you're not really an economist, are you? And there I was, having just graduated economics, leading economist, head of the department, so I got him to, well, if you say so. He said, but what we want in this country now needs is some good business people. We have a graduate course in business administration. Why don't you go and take that for a year? And so I said, well, that's fine, but how can I finance that? And then he said, this was in the old days of the old boys' network. He said, you're on a state scholarship, aren't you? And I said, yes. He said, I don't think that'd be a problem. He wrote me three lines in longhand, just scribbled it, said, take that over to the ministry. So I went over to Curzon Street, dug out the relevant civil servant, who just said, all right, we'll extend your scholarship for another year. Nothing, you know what the business. I then went to this graduate course in business. In those days, there was no business quadrant, and this was a precursor in a way. In a way, it was an awful waste of resources, but it had the most amazing bunch of professors teaching it. And very hardly anyone in Britain was interested in taking it. So the year I was there, there were, I think, two other Brits, maybe three. And a bunch of Americans who were there because they had astutely discovered under GI Bill they could spend a year in London at the US government's expense. Found this course to sign up with, and there they were. And a few other Europeans. And that was it. So we did this. I did this course. I learned how to play bridge with the Americans. I'd never played bridge before. I had a lot of leg pulling from them once they discovered I was a socialist. I was saying, you know, you've got to go to America and find out what the world's really like and so on. And I was then persuaded maybe I should go to America. And that year, and for a couple of years afterwards, there was something called a King George's Memorial Fellowship. So I thought I'd apply for that. So I went to see old Robbins again, and he said, oh, yeah, I'll write you a letter for that. And of course, he was such a sort of big wheeler and dealer that that was incredibly important. So I got that and went off to America and didn't come back for many years, actually. But I think what was interesting about those days is, although probably statistically the school already was probably quite biased abusing accountants and commercial lawyers and people like that, the ambience and the soul of the school was very sort of left-wing intellectuals. And I think it was about that time it began to shift, whether for the better or not, is for you to, you know, whoever decides anything. Tom, anything else? I mean,
is there anything else that we haven't covered that you would like to?
I don't know. Yeah, for me, it's a bit difficult to remember now, but it was extraordinary business coming to LSE, because no one in my family even knew what a university was, actually. And so for me, it was an enormous transition. And so if I think about those years, you know, there's so many things I can remember, and if you had a couple of days, we could sit and go over them all. But you obviously don't have a couple of days. I guess diminishing return sets and a lot of them probably aren't that interesting to anyone else. So I remember have a few strange, odd memories. One, there was a famous professor here called William Robson, who's professor of public administration. I remember taking him around Uganda some years later. And him being very excited when we visited a place where the pictures of three presidents of East Africa, and one of them was of Jomo Kenyatta. And what got Robson excited was Kenyatta in this formal photograph, a coloured photograph, wearing an LSE tie, because he had been a student here as well. I kept on coming across LSE people later. The other thing, one thing which always impressed me about LSE, and I don't think it would be possible now, was maybe the years I was here, I never studied with them, but maybe one of the most influential figures in LSE was Richard Titmuss. Have you come across him in these discussions yet?
No.
I suppose most of the people you're talking to from rather later years, because I'm not certain how many people are around from my time. But Titmuss was the first professor of social administration here, and he was really the first guy who started writing seriously about and systematically about the welfare state, issues about social administration and welfare state. Where I was impressed, and I say I'd not even certainly be possible now, is not only was Titmuss not a graduate, he didn't even have A-levels, he just had O-levels, all right? And he had started writing about social policy as a clerk in an insurance company, and obviously made his way, got known, taken on interest by LSE, eventually became a professor, and in a way starting a whole new subject. And in a way, if you're doing this, you should try and find some of the people who knew him. Because there were a few of these figures that strike me as being in the history of the school in the 30s, 40s, and 50s were sort of the clearly dominant figures. R.H. Tawney was one of them, who I met two or three times when he was already in his 80s. So he went back to the Victorian period. You don't know his name, huh? There's obviously a blank when I say that. You know. What is your subject, Tom?
I'm a mathematician by training, but I currently do work for LSE in creation of video and audio content. Hands in many pies.
Well, if you're a mathematician, you become an economist, but it's all sorts of third-rate mathematicians become star economists almost immediately, so. A little bit of advice to you. Tawney must have come here in the 20s, and he was not only a major economist, he was involved in a very famous controversy on religion and the rise of capitalism. But also, he was one of the really more serious philosophers of the British labour movement. He wrote a book called Equality, which is one of the more interesting statements of what, from a non-Marxian perspective, on it, and also a book called The Acquisitive Society, about what it might mean to be a socialist. Well, if anything else occurs to you, let me know.
Okay. Thank you for your time, Brian.